with a work session on Senate Bill 306, which was passed and then brought back at the same meeting last week. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I thought it was in House Judiciary for a second, so my apologies. Senate Bill 306 comes to you from Representative Bill Morissette. And you may remember this bill from last Thursday when we adopted the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments, which gave us the Dash 4 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments, Madam Chair, members of the committee, basically allow signs in liquor stores so that you can see them from the outside. Now there's currently a prohibition at the bottom. If you have your Dash 2 amendments in the back of page 2, in no event shall signs or displays authorized by the commission be placed in positions within the store where the sign or display would be readily visible from outside of the store. And the Dash 2 amendments, that removes that language. The Dash 3 amendments, Madam Chair, members of the committee, on page 1, line 4, any equipment other than filters. Currently there's a prohibition by manufacturer or wholesaler from giving materials, gratuities, or furniture, equipment to a person, a retail licensee. And this provision would remove the term filter from that, so you could give a filter. You may remember we heard testimony concerning filters that were used on the carbon dioxide that is used to pump out beer from a keg. So those two amendments were adopted. They were in the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Council Committee. As we heard last week, we thought this was the Dash 3 amendments was a very simple, minor thing, and it turns out to be more major than people had been aware. I'm perfectly happy to have that policy discussion, but it will have to occur at another place and time. We have the bill before us. I believe the process would be Senator Starr, for you to...
Madam Chair, I move to rescind the vote by which we passed the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 306.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved that we rescind the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 306. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 306, as amended by the Dash 2 only amendments, to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved the Senate Bill 306 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this. Okay, now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 948, which is becoming a familiar fixture in the judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 948 comes here from Senator Prozonsky. You have the Dash 4 amendments in front of you, and I spoke with Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office just before the meeting, and what you see in front of you, given the complexity of the statute, what he did was break them out into different pieces. What you have in the statute now is a provision for selling to people who are visibly intoxicated and selling to people who are under the age. And what he did was create a new section for each one of those particular provisions. And let me get the copy that I put through with Dave on. I'm starting over on page 3. This would be the new language as it relates to selling to people under 21. The bold language that you see on 2 in the top of page 3 is the current language as it relates to selling to visibly intoxicated individuals. And starting in section 3, it sets forth what the current law is plus additions to it. For example, on lines 19 and 20, it says this section does not apply to sacrament wine given or provided as part of religious service. There is currently a provision that allows a minor to accept wine as part of a sacrament wine as part of a religious service. Then we go down below that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and it starts off with basically a new penalty provision. The person who violates subsection 1 or 2 of this section commits a Class C misdemeanor and is subject to a fine of not less than $500. And Chairman of the Committee, the current provision calls for a first offense, a Class A misdemeanor, with a fine of up to $350 for the first offense. And then the court shall order a person who is convicted under this subsection to complete a program that addresses the personal and social impact of alcohol consumption. And then subsection 2, for a second offense, to be guilty of a Class B misdemeanor and is subject to a mandatory minimum fine of $1,500. The court shall order the driving privileges and the right to apply for driving privileges of a person convicted under this subsection to be suspended for a period not to exceed 90 days. This person will be allowed to apply for a hardship permit after 30 days. And subsection 7, a person who violates subsection 1 and 2 of this section a third or subsequent time is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor and is subject to a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 days of imprisonment and a maximum fine of $2,000. Court may not waive or suspend the imposition or execution of the mandatory minimum period of incarceration prescribed in this subsection. Then it goes on, the court shall order that the driving privileges and right to apply these privileges, this subsection shall be suspended for a period not to exceed 1 year. It allows for a hardship permit after 90 days. Then it says subsection 8, in addition to the mandatory minimum sentence, the court may require the violator to make restitution of any damages. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's current law. And then the mandatory minimum penalty provisions of driving privileges do not apply to a person's license under the provision of this chapter to an agent appointed under the pertinent ORS provision or to employee of the licensee or agent, and then this is new, unless the person knowingly sells, gives, or otherwise makes available alcoholic beverages to a person under the age of 21 years. And then section 10 is new. If a person is charged with violating subsection 1 and 2 of this section, the person has not previously been convicted of violating subsection 1 and 2 of this section, the district attorney shall impose a diversion agreement to the defendant under ORS 135.891, the other pertinent provisions, ORS sections. Diversion agreements under this section are not subject to ORS 135.905, which is a unitary assessment. Then it goes on, a condition of entering a diversion agreement under this subsection, the defendant must pay a filing fee of $350. Then there's a new provision further down on page 5. A court shall give written notice to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission of a conviction under 1 and 2 of this section if the person is a licensee and the offense is committed in the course of the person's occupation or employment.
Okay. Senator Walker.
The summary talks about a dash 2 and a dash 3, but I have a dash 4. Is that what you've been talking about, Mr. Taylor?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. When these amendments were literally completed at about 12:15 this morning and 12:15 this afternoon, I know Mr. Senator Przanski got the amendments just thereafter, and I was down in Dave Hendricks' office going through these amendments at 12:45. So these are amendments that replace the dash 2 and dash 3. The Sacramento wine one is incorporated in that. I also believe that the dash 3 is. These are the amendments we had before us the last time. There were problems with them. You may remember that Brad Swank from Court Administrator's Office pointed out some problems as it related to having the first offense treated as a violation and the difficulty in the courts in tracking all that. Mm-hmm. I believe Senator Przanski's office has worked with the courts and other interested parties to draft around those problems.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Walker.
Well, the same provision is still in here. I wrote you a note some time back that I'm opposed to this bill because there's no nexus between the offense and the sanction, and I still feel that way. You're taking away someone's driving privileges for buying alcohol for someone when they're not in their vehicle, they're not driving, they're just buying alcohol. I like the addition of requiring the person who's convicted of that crime to get alcohol treatment or some kind of a program, but taking your license away, there's no nexus for me, so I can't support this bill.
I appreciate that, Senator Walker.
I've never been here with this, so.
Okay. Senator Przanski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is basically a culmination of work that you've asked me to do with one of the interested parties for their client. And what we did with the dash 4 is we took into consideration the issues, the points I will clarify is that the diversion, the reason we're doing, we were looking at potentially treating the first offense as a violation, thinking that it would be better to try to do something education-wise to get these individuals aware of what they're doing before they something seriously occurred. Because of a case of Brown versus Multnomah County, saying that if you have enhanced penalties in the second or subsequent conviction, then you basically have to show that that person had an attorney or some type of advice of their rights, etc. So we're going to leave it as it currently is, which would be a misdemeanor. We are allowing for that first offense to be treated as a diversion. That in itself will, in fact, allow the individual to go through a alcohol awareness type program, pay fees, which I'll point out to the committee, I think is pretty well assessed as to how it should go. $112 goes into the Department of Revenue criminal assessment fines, as you see in other diversion agreements. $100 is being distributed as part of the cost. And I think the more important part is the $138 $350 will be going into an account that is used for drug and alcohol treatment and programs of education. And so hopefully that will actually have more of a nexus. In response to Senator Walker's concern about the nexus with the driver's license, the people who brought the bill forward actually wanted to have the license suspended on the very first incident. And we worked with them, and they agreed to allow that to be effective on the second incident. So, and my concern is that I think a lot of the individuals who could get caught up in this are that age of 18 to 21, mm-hmm. Who could be having a party, who could be basically providing to their own friend alcohol, and I think that it's better to get the education, and they agreed, and that's why it is. I will say that we have other statutes on the books, including lack or failure to pay child support, that can in fact cause people to lose their occupational licenses and stuff like that. So I understand the concern that Senator Walker may have on this, but what we're attempting to do is make it where it would still meet the goals of the proponents of the bill, and at the same time taking consideration that those who may come into the system only once can actually walk out of there with education, paying a small fee, and basically not have a criminal conviction on their record, which current law would require to be assessed. And if they choose not to do the diversion, they can pay at least $500, go to the alcohol awareness, and end up with the misdemeanor on their record.
I appreciate that explanation, Madam Chair, but I've never supported these bills that use a driver's license. I think in my first or second term, there was a bill that would take away driver's licenses for kids who didn't attend school. I can't go there. But if you have votes on the committee, move it out.
I appreciate that, Senator Walker. It's just a philosophical issue, and I respect your standing up for your... Hopefully your differences on this. Is there any discussion? Go ahead.
I want to put on the record that the driver license suspension that we're talking about would not go into effect until there was a second or subsequent conviction.
Correct. Okay, any other discussion or questions? I wanted to thank the Mr. Douglas and Ms. Buck and their client, Diageo, for being flexible and working with Senator Prezansky. I think it's a good package to crack down on people who provide underage people with alcohol. How's the committee feeling about this? We're missing a couple of members, so we probably have to have a pretty positive attitude to go forward at this point. I see smiles coming from over there. Okay. Senator Starr, we have the -4 amendments in front of us.
I'm Chair. I move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 948.
Senator Starr has moved the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 948. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
No.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
4 ayes, 1 nay, 2 excused.
Okay. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 948 floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 948 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. We can use a repeat of the roll call, Dale. Thank you.
Senator Pruszynski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
No.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
4 ayes, 1 nay, 2 excused.
Senate Bill 948 is amended, is adopted. Senator Pruszynski will carry this. Okay, I think we'll do a public hearing on, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2230. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2230A comes to us from the Attorney General's Restitution Task Force. This measure came out of the House Judiciary Committee and the House of Representatives without opposition. This really does two things to the restitution statute. It provides new definitions of restitution of pecuniary damages, and it provides a new definition of victim, and it establishes a payment priority for the receipt of restitution. The term pecuniary damages, which currently exists in the restitution statute, would be changed to economic damages, as that term is defined in the tort actions chapter, the definition of victim would be changed to include the actual victim of crime, a third party that the court has determined has suffered economic damage as a result of the defendant's criminal conduct, the criminal injuries compensation account, and an insurance carrier that has expended monies on behalf of a crime victim. The measure in Section 4 establishes a priority of payment of both compensatory fines and restitution where there are multiple victims. And that order is set up in the following order. The crime victim receives priority, followed by the criminal injuries compensation account, followed by the non-victim determined to have suffered damages, along with the insurer.
Thank you. We have signed up Fred Boss and Connie Gallagher from Department of Justice.
Madam Chair, we have one other individual who isn't signed up.
Well, there's another chair there. Otherwise, they'd be out of luck. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the Director of Crime Victims Assistance at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to testify in support of the bill. In addition to my testimony, I am also submitting written testimony from the Multnomah District Attorney's Office, who is in support of this bill, and I would also like to mention that Crime Victims United supports this bill. However, they are unable to provide testimony today. Victims suffer staggering losses as a result of a crime. The tangible costs of personal crime, including medical expenses and loss of earnings, as well as the costs of public victim assistance services, is estimated at $105 billion per year nationally. And in Oregon, it is easily over $10 million per biennium. The costs of crime can be shouldered by victims and those service providers to victims, or it can be shifted over to the person who has caused the harm. The direct relationship between the harm and the ordering of restitution gives, I believe, a more precise deterrent effect than, say, what might be a more traditional fine. It also promotes the government's interest in rehabilitation in addition to that of deterrence. 18 states, including Oregon, give victims a right to restitution through a constitutional amendment. There are many other states that provide this right through their statutory structure. Yet in spite of this, what we see is that restitution is probably the most often unenforced victim's right within the criminal justice and the juvenile justice systems. Last legislative session, Senate Bill 617 was enacted, and this provided significant support for this policy direction of holding offenders accountable for the economic damages that they cause as a result of their criminal act. The bill in front of you provides clarification of the direction that was set last session through Senate Bill 617. What House Bill 2230 provides, number one, is consistency for restitution orders. What we have discovered throughout the course of implementing Senate Bill 617 is that the orders are inconsistent in part because of definitional issues. The term pecuniary damages is a term that was not well defined in statute. The term economic damages is defined in ORS 31.170. So as counsel shared with you earlier, this bill does suggest that we change the statutory language to one that will provide for greater consistency by using a term that the bench is familiar with and that is clearly defined in statute. House Bill 2230 also provides for specific payment priorities, which again we think is important from a victim standpoint. It will provide for the direct victim to be the priority for payment, and only after the victim has received full payment, then would crime victims' compensation and other third parties receive payment. Last year, our two revenue agents at Crime Victims Assistance collected a little bit over $400,000 through restitution that's used for future crime victims' costs. These go back out through the Crime Victims Compensation Program. If this bill passes, we certainly hope that we will see larger recovery next year, next biennium, for future victim costs. But I can assure you that this bill is needed, and we certainly encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you. Who wants to go next?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss, and I'm Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2230. House Bill 2230 is proposed by the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force. It provides for three clarifications to the current restitution law to aid the courts in providing restitution for victims of crime. First, it substitutes for the vague term pecuniary damages the term economic damages as it is defined in ORS 31710. Courts and litigants have struggled with defining pecuniary damages. And the introductory section will probably give you a capsule of why. Pecuniary damages are defined as all special damages, but not general damages, which a person may recover in a civil action. A very vague term that has been interpreted by each court in its own manner. The term economic damages is defined in the ORS, and it is more precise and has a litany of exactly what is meant by economic damages. Second, the House Bill 2230 provides clarity in the definition of who is a victim for the purpose of a restitution award. A victim is, number one, the actual person who was affected by the crime. Damage. In addition, a victim is all others who have suffered economic damages as a result of the crime. Some courts would not include insurance carriers and the crime victim section as who have paid for a victim's loss as eligible for a restitution award. And this might come up if a, for example, if a car was stolen. It's worth $10,000, yet the person has a insurance policy in place with a $200 deductible. Some courts would only place as the restitution award the $200 deductible and not the full amount of the $10,000 loss. What that does is allow either a windfall for the defendant who doesn't have to pay the full amount of his crime, and it increases the insurance costs for the rest of the people because that cost is spread out. The third clarification in House Bill 2230 is that the bill does provide for an order of payment if there are multiple victims. First, the actual victim of the crime is compensated for their actual loss. Next, crime victims is reimbursed for the amount that they've paid out to the victim that to suffer for their damages, And then finally, all others who have suffered an economic loss are compensated. That concludes my testimony. I'd be pleased to attempt to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. We had another bill before us, House Bill, I believe it's House Bill 2222 on subrogation. How does this fit in with that bill?
I don't recall this, Chair Burdick, I don't recall at this moment what 2222 was.
Counsel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Boss, I believe 2222A cleaned up the provision regarding liens on judgments or settlements or compromises obtained by individuals who had obtained a judgment on a private cause of action when the crime victims section has already paid out funds and assistance to that person. And this would provide that the crime victims section would have a lien on those amounts. It would require the crime victim who had filed a claim to give notice to the department of that claim. And there was, I believe, a section with respect to third party subrogation by which if the victim of crime was successful in obtaining a judgment from a third party and the proper notice had been given, then I'm going to say this wrong, thinking ahead of what I'm speaking, then I believe the crime victim section had a right of action against the third party if any payments were made.
Thank you, Counsel. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I was not the Assistant Attorney General who worked on that particular statute. I believe the interaction would be only as it relates to restitution. So the focus of that statute that addressed third party, a judgment against a third party or an action against a third party, this has nothing to do with that.
This is restitution. The other pertains to civil lawsuits.
Correct. Chair Burdick, correct. Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome, Walt.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I, on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, I'd offer up my support of House Bill 2230, the A and Gross version that's before you. 3 points. I guess this bill provides a better roadmap for the scope of recoverable losses, and I think it would assist greatly in the courtroom where judges and the parties try to work through restitution's workup and get to the actual need. So I think it's a good roadmap. Secondly, defining who is eligible also is going to assist the courts, and there's going to be less grappling then in the courtrooms over, well, who is a third party. And finally, this prioritization is very important. It's going to, from my perspective, lead to a better management of the resources as well as they try to work through allocating the different issues relating to restitution and puts the victim at the top of that, and that's exactly what is appropriate. So with those three things together, I just offer my support today.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Kelly Skye.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And first, I need to respectfully disagree with the summary given by Counsel O'Leary that said that this bill was unopposed in the House. I will say that on the morning of the public hearing on this bill, I woke up with a stomach flu, was unable to attend the hearing, and I did submit written testimony by email and was informed that it was admitted into the record. I don't know whether that is actually heard. We did make attempts to oppose it in the House.
Counsel, do you wish to defend yourself?
Madam Chair, I will, members of the committee and Ms. Skye, I will say when I said it passed unopposed, what I was referring to was the votes in the House Judiciary. This measure passed 7-0 two were missing, Representative Thatcher and Representative Wirth. And on the floor of the House, the measure passed with 55 aye votes, and there were five members absent.
Council, you've done an admirable job of defending yourself. Please proceed. I think Council's ahead on this one.
Okay. Chair Burke, I just didn't want anybody to think that we hadn't objected to it on the other side.
I appreciate that, and I hope you're feeling better.
I have distributed written testimony, which deals with just one of the issues that we have with this bill, and that is the idea behind changing the term pecuniary damages to economic damages. And while on its face that appears to be a technical fix, which I agree keeps this criminal statute in line with how damages are defined in the civil statute. The terms economic and non-economic damages were actually passed in 1987 as part of a tort reform package, and with that tort reform package, they placed the cap on non-economic damages, which is pain and suffering and emotional type damages. And so when they did that, some of the things that had traditionally been determined to be general damages as opposed to special damages were moved over into the economic category to avoid the cap on non-economic damages. And I point specifically to loss of future earnings capacity as something that was not allowed under restitution under the current definition of pecuniary or special damages that now would be allowed under economic damages. My point being that this is not just a technical, this doesn't just change the name that we call damages, it expands what is awardable as a restitution. And I think it's important that that the committee knows this. And I can provide counsel with the cases that I'm referring to, but I get that specific expansion explanation from DeVoe versus Presby, which is a 1995 Court of Appeals case. And I think that this is really significant for one big reason, and that is that with the changes that have occurred in the area of restitution, both last session and now expanding it here, I think that what we've arrived at is the day when we're going to require a jury trial on the award of restitution. And that issue was addressed by the Supreme Court in State versus Hart, which is a 1985 Supreme Court case. And in that case, the defendant had argued that they were entitled to a jury trial on the issue of restitution, and the court found that, no, in fact, they weren't entitled to a jury trial under Article 1, I think it's Section 17. Mm-hmm. Article 1, Section 17 of the Oregon Constitution provides that in all civil cases the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate. And the only reason that the court found that restitution didn't reach that constitutional provision was because the restitution was considered penal in nature, that it was limited, and that the court was able to consider the defendant's ability to pay. Now we're here, we're expanding the amount of the types of damages that are recoverable under restitution. We've taken away the court's authority. Last session, we took away the court's authority to take into consideration the defendant's ability to pay. And we're adding in to the statute subrogated victims, and I'm not even sure whether the Crime Victims Compensation Fund, I guess that would be considered a subrogated victim. So we've expanded it to the point where not only is the court required to order full restitution and of the victim's out-of-pocket expenses, but we're talking future earning capability and amounts that have been paid out by others. And OCDLA believes that this will require a jury trial on the issue of restitution in the future.
Okay, so what you're saying here is that it might get wrapped into Blakely if it's expanded, because the Court of Appeals held on the 4th of this month that the awarding of restitution by the court in a criminal case does not violate Blakely under the current statute. So what you're saying is that by expanding it, you're putting it at risk of a Blakely ruling?
Chair Burdick, actually, I think it's a separate issue from Blakely. Blakely deals specifically with sentencing, and what I'm talking about is actually a different section of the Constitution, and that's Article 1, Section 17, which deals with your constitutional right to a civil jury trial over damages. If I sue another person over a traffic accident, that person has a Oregon constitutional right to a jury trial, both on liability or causation, whether, you know, who caused the accident, but also on the amount of damages. And a jury listens to the evidence of my injuries, of my loss of future earnings capacity, and also the non-economic damages, which we're not, I don't think we're dealing with here, although that's not clear when you bring Crime Victims Compensation Fund in, because I'm not, I don't know the parameters of what they pay out. But so it's that civil right to a jury trial that I think will be invoked, and that's the right that's discussed by the Supreme Court in this Hart case, as opposed to, I think, the Blakely falls under constitution or under criminal
right.
constitutional
okay.
rights.
Okay, glad you clarified that. Thank you.
And so I've sort of touched upon the other concern, which is adding the Crime Victims Compensation Fund as a victim and someone who can recover under the restitution statute. Again, and I should have probably researched this a little bit more before I got here, but I'm not sure what the parameters are for what they will pay out. And I think that in order to put that there, to put them in a statute that is that requires a judge to order the full amount that's requested, that we look at what exactly they're paying out, because at this point they pay out what they choose to pay out, not necessarily what a judge finds is compensable under the restitution statute as pecuniary damages or in the future economic damages. So I think what's going to happen there is that you're going to see defense attorneys subpoenaing the Crime Victims Compensation fund records, the victims' applications for benefits, and there's going to be litigation and argument for jury trial on whether those damages are recoverable under the restitution statute. That may go along with the third party insurance companies or the other people who suffer damages. In a civil case, if I sue somebody else for a traffic accident, if the passenger who was in my car also wants to recover for damages that occurred, they would also have to bring a civil action. And here you're letting them come in under a criminal provision that does not have a right to a jury trial. So you're expanding it to such a point that I think it's going to violate what the civil jury trial provisions in Article 1, Section 17. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2230. And open a work session on Senate Bill 199. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 199 comes to us from the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. We had a public hearing on this measure on February 1st, and since that time, the parties under the direction of Ron L. Shankle, under the supervision of Ron L. Shankle from the Department of Justice, have proposed a Dash 2 amendment that is in your packet. This is, to refresh your recollection, this is a bill that applies to protective orders in sex cases, and it is specific to sex cases, and it defines two different categories under the Dash 2 amendment. It defines two different categories of information that would be subject to a protective order that must be issued by the court if requested by either the district attorney or the alleged victim. The first kind is defined in Section 1, Sub 5, and that has to do with essentially any information of a sexually explicit nature. The second type of information that this applies to is in Section 1, Sub 6. And it's a little more narrow. It applies to any recording of the alleged victim describing their sexual victimization. And there's also an escape hatch in Section 6, although the court has to enter the order as to the evidence that applies to Section 5. In Section 6, the court may decide not to if the court finds good cause. Then the Dash 2 also enumerates a series of exceptions to this protective order, to either protective order, which would permit copying and dissemination if it's for purposes of discovery, if it's for purposes of submitting evidence to a grand jury, for examination by an expert, for providing copies to the party's attorneys, for sharing evidence with state agencies in furtherance of statutorily imposed duties. And there's also the exception that was in the original measure, which is to provide a copy to the alleged victim if the alleged victim requests a copy. The other important thing that the Dash 2 does is it makes clear that any of this evidence that's subject to either the Sub 6 protective order, or the Sub 5 protective order may not be unsealed. So it is, if the order is granted, it is permanently sealed, and that is different than the current statute, which gives the court discretion to unseal the subject of a protective order after the conclusion of the case.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Schenkel, did you want to add anything to this? Okay, hunky-dory. Okay, are there any questions of counsel from the committee? This is a priority for our Attorney General, and we have a Dash 2 amendment in front of us, and we are in work session. Hint, Senator Stark?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 199.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 199. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 199 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 199 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
So be it. Let's see. Committee, we've got party season coming up. For those of us who are here, we won't tell the people who are absent about the party.
Oh, my God.
We're having a practice party on, and I'll get a memo out to all of you, on June 2nd at the traditional Judiciary Haunt, the Joel Palmer House. And then we're having a joint party with the House Judiciary Committee on June 6th. And that's a lot of parties to demand of this committee, but that's the way it got set up. So,
Chair, are they both at the Joel Palmer House?
No, they're not both at the Joel Palmer House. The one on the 6th will be somewhere here in Salem.
Oh, because that's the memo I got was... That was at the Joel Palmer House.
You got a memo?
I did.
Well, you're way ahead of me, Senator Walker.
I did. Well, you know, I sniffed the Joel Palmer House within my pile of goods.
No, the Joel Palmer House is actually a better place for a small party. Anyway, I will be getting a memo out to you, but I wanted to give you a heads up as quickly as I know, which was today.
That means I have to plan the committee party for our committee, don't I, Charles?
Right.
So, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Yeah, here it is. Right here.